Let me welcome everybody who's here and indicate that when we did work before we went on a week's research, which was constituency week, and now we're back. We will continue where we left off, particularly with the ACTO and the NLTA amendment bill. So without much ado, I am going to request the acting director general to take us through the processes of the land transport amendment bill so that we can be able to move on. Honorable members, welcome once more. Department of Transport, our members of the community, everybody, you're all welcome. Right on, brother.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members and the colleagues from the Department. Honorable Chair, the manner we had prepared was that I would open and give just a little background. But then the colleagues led by Chief Director Lusanda, who's also doubling up as DDG, acting DDG Public Transport, would take the committee through the responses to the both oral and written questions, they all combined. But she seems to be still be stuck at the registration. And nevertheless, because this is a this is my terrain. I will continue. Chair, we, as a way of background, the National Land Transport Act, NLTA, number 5/2009, was promulgated in December of 2009. And in the course of implementation, there were a number of developments that we then noticed in terms of that act needing to be amended. Some of those things were typos, some of those things were matters of clarification in terms of definitions, some of them were to more elaborate on issues around NMT, but Chair, you should also remember that as we were developing that act, we then rolled out what we termed IRPTS or IPTS, commonly known as BRT in the bigger cities, and that then taught us a number of lessons. But also of significance, I think the principal acts also assumed that there will be capacity at the local sphere of government, and that has proven not to be necessarily the case in many of the municipalities. There's just a few of those that can take over the responsibility in terms of contracting for public transport in particular, but also for economic regulation, issuing of operating license. So we excluded provinces and national to intervene in case of issues like non-capacity. That is what we are putting in. But there's also technology that came through, notably in the meter taxis or sedan type taxis, in that a technology called electronic hailing came into our space, and there was really no provision for it in terms of definition, in terms of the standards, in terms of regulation, yeah, but also in terms of accommodating it in mainstream public transport. We then are dealing with the issues of those. That is the background in terms of why we are amending the NLTA. What I will then do, I will go to directly the responses as they were presented. Hey, the writing is very small, but I think the hard copy is much clearer. Chair. We will deal with the comments made by South African Meter Taxi Association, City of Cape Town, the Division for Transport there called Transport for Cape Town. We will then deal with the input, comments, presentation by Uber. Those are the e-hailing people, but also Uber users, guilds. There is also comments by Salga, and there are comments by a number of associations, taxi associations, and so on. Now, slide number 5 talks to the input by the South African Meter Taxi Association. We've got 42 slides in total. I will run quite quickly, more especially where we are trying to indicate why a particular comment or input cannot be accommodated in the Act, and then those that we agree with, and perhaps we will be in a position to deal with them positively in the amendment. We will move much quicker. Now, SAMTA, South African Meter Taxi Association, in the main objected to the what they call the to bringing into their space Uber and the likes of Uber. Those are the issues related to e-hailing. They actually are saying that e-hailing without support by a physical meter may not necessarily, they are objecting to it, not that it is illegal. But of course, I think this is an area which is unknown, and that is an area where we therefore then are bringing clarity, both in terms of the definition, but also in terms of how it is going to be regulated. I will deal with the Uber itself and the implications looking to the e-hailing as we proceed. And then again, the issue around the electronic hailing application using smartphones is not a taxi meter. Again, this issue, is in an environment where legislation provides for a meter only, you would definitely find people who are object to something else that is not a meter. Hence the introduction of e-hailing and how it must be incorporated into mainstream public transport. Both of those, and then the one in slide number 6 talk to the very same thing. I think it is just an issue of saying e-hailing is not provided for. Why do you put e-hailing without the meter? Somewhere in the amendment, I think it's section 66, we are indicating, and we have recognized the fact that you would have instances where e-hailing, which uses a cell phone network, might be out of coverage of a particular network. And we are indicating in those instances, then a meter can be installed together with the e-hailing. And then the City of Cape Town, Chair, that is slide number 7. The City of Cape Town talks to the expansion in terms of the definition of IPTN. But they wanted us to include, to insert certain words in the A section or A clause of the bill. where we are referring only to road base and not rail. But I think it's an issue of semantics, really, because IPTN, its definition is includes an integrated system that talks to all modes of transport, including rail. And then we definitely agree with them in terms of the issue around motorized and non-motorized wheelchairs, which we welcome. Obviously, the positive input will include that. And then they also wanted an inclusion. I mean, that municipalities can have own branding in terms of public transport. Here, Chair, is the in the Act, we said that the public transport vehicles should be branded. And then the minister shall prescribe the manner by way of regulation in terms of how they should be branded. Have these cases that have got the spiraling SA flag. But the city there was talking to instances where a particular city or municipality can have own colors for public transport. That they should be given that latitude to then brand in the manner that they decide and design. Of course, the NLTA does not prevent them from doing that. Hence, the My City colors are different from the Rea Vaya colors, the Ariane, the Purple, Lea Tonapulukwane, different colors. RRP in that back also different colors. So the Act talks about branding and does not necessarily say that national should therefore determine the type of branding. What we are emphasizing is that public transport should be different from any other ordinary vehicle for purposes of law enforcement, easy identification, and the like. Again, on slide number 8, the city is recommending that issue around the capacity that we speak about, and they say we need to clarify in terms of what is meant when we say in relation to necessary capacity. But also we there's a document in terms of minimum requirements for comprehensive integrated transport plans, where the issue of capacity is addressed in chapter 6 thereof. And I think what we are responding to is definitely the capacity issues that talk to, in particular, transport planning. We're not necessarily far away from each other, and we say that this suffices and clarity can be provided in terms of regulations. The other issue, they wanted us also, or they were against the proposal in terms of the expansion of the definition of municipal regulating an entity. In the manner we put it, that they must receive and decide application relating to operating license for services wholly within the area. I think they're talking also about adjacent municipalities. If you look at it, it's not really a bad thing that they propose, except that it will be murky or create blurred responsibilities because the progress is there to deal with interprovincial services between municipalities. So, it would of necessity not really want the regulating authority of one municipality to then have jurisdiction in another municipality. This is basically why we are having a problem with that. And then the third is the one that speaks to the qualifications. I think we spoke about this issue around qualifications. We were trying to clarify in that we generalize people with the knowledge of, without relying specifically on what they need to do, and they say this should be expanded also to MRPs, which we are saying they are, it's catered for in Section 17. Page 9, they then say that the planning authority cannot take steps to cancel operating licenses and permits. It should rather state that upon recommendation or request of the planning authority, the regulating entity shall take steps to do such. Now, what we are indicating here, so you see, they're separating the role of that planning authority and that of the regulating entity. I think while we are not necessarily against that, but we are trying to clarify how what we will, in response to this, incorporate. In that, we will insert where appropriate, the relevant regulating entity must take measures. Then there is a section that cross referred to the Road Accident Fund of 1996 in terms of fault or no fault issues. They say why should we delete that paragraph? Initially, through the years, when you apply for an operating license, there was a need to for you to obtain what you call third party insurance. And that was to deal with the matters of this nature. But that has been superseded, way back to even with the promulgation of the Road Accident Fund. Now, we say it's relevant for them because we're no longer requiring people to then produce insurances because it's taken care of in the RAF Act. In fact, it's going to be more clearer in the RAPT benefit scheme that is being proposed. Now, there are therefore then a number of issues in relation to what the principal heir should have said and what they are proposing. The amendments proposed to Section 77 have the following implications. So, the 7 years, the query of the 7 years, which ends in 2016, but also talks to 2020, which is an additional 5 years. This is the issue around conversion for purposes of operating public transport. This chair, if you look at the principal act, had a cut-off date for conversion. But I think for various reasons, this cut-off will not be met, which was December 2016, for a number of reasons. One, our system just could not deal with the backlogs in the provinces in particular. But two, there is no response from operators also. Give us a problem. Which then means then that we need to revisit the principal act in terms of the original cutoff date of 2016. Okay. I've spoken to the team to see if we cannot remove the issue of the date, because if we extend this by a further 5 years and come 2020 we are not finished again, we will have a problem with legislation. So I think the most important thing, and this is basically what the amendment still must say, so this is the proposal we're trying to make. The issue around dates, we need to take it out and put it in regulation. We need to just say by a date determined by the minister. Because here we said they must be converted within 7 years. The 7 years expires on the 8th of December, and I don't think we are halfway. We are not even halfway, I'm told. That is the city of Cape Town. I will take on the Uber while Lusanda is finding her feet, which is such a phrase, or feet, to continue with the 3.4 going forward. Uber technology, the long and short of it is operating sedan type vehicles, more like meter taxis. The difference there is that they can contract Matabata Mukonyama, who is having a road with the vehicle, and then he can operate on Uber tickets. Like I indicated, the major difference there is basically that one, that the way meter taxis have owner-operator, Uber contract out people who have vehicles to provide public transport. The second thing is that Uber then uses an app, an application technology. Is it of a meter? Now, I don't know whether 2009 we had quite a few BBTs, Honorable Chair, in the drafts of this legislation. BBTs are bought before technology. So it was not anticipated that down the line, somebody would create an app, and then that app can then be used for acquiring the public transport services and also measuring or calculating the distance, but also then also calculating a fee. Now, that is what Uber is doing. And Uber has been doing it for some time outside the country. They came into the country, they then wanted to occupy that space. When they came into the country, they found out that they're in South Africa, if you provide transport for work, you must have an operating license, the bottom line. Whether it is public transport, scheduled services, or commercial services, whether you are contracted to a mine, or you are contracted to Shoprite Checkers, or OK, you must have the right, you must be provided with an operating license. I mean, the difference between public transport and commercial services is that commercial services, you just need to produce a contract and then automatically we give you operating license, whereas for public transport, then you need to apply through regulatory entities or operating license boards. And then the application gets adjudicated upon, and then in terms of FIDA, people can come and object. Now, then Uber was then told that they need to apply for operating license. But as they then were flooding the provinces. It was then realized that their technology is not provided for in the legislation, the electronic hailing. Currently what happens is the first provinces to give them operating license, they gave them charter services operating licenses. And then it was found that no, their services is basically closely related to those of meters, taxis, and the services that they are using in apps. There, if you look at their proposal, they came to the department, but then we had hard discussions. If you look at their proposal, they're trying to push us to heavy provisions that would make them operate like charter services. The difference here is the charter services is the service that can start in one province and in eight more provinces, like tourist services. And travel services in the principal health, they no longer get operating licenses, but they are accredited. We could not do that. We then indicated that we will then provide a provision for e-hailing and have provisions that are similar to those of metaxis in terms of how they apply. Issues around objections, but it still does not mean that you cannot take a Uber taxi from here in Cape Town to Polokwane, because that subsection, I think it's 66C, provides that you can take your passenger to wherever and bring him back. The meter taxis can do the same. That is the difference between a charter service and the services provided by Uber, who in likelihood are very close to meter taxis. And then there are subsections that we are then are amending to accommodate the hailing. We had several discussions because we then said we just expanded on the in the amendments in their current form, we expanded on the definition of metatrixes. But I think we are amenable and we are not opposed to the fact that we can still keep metatrixes and have a separate definition for the changes. Because that was just an addition, and then we take out that addition and put it separately, give it its own definition. And, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on which side you are, the other provisions will look exactly the same as are provided in terms of how they need to be regulated. I think the other issue was how then the applications should be attended to. That is slide number 12 by the municipalities. And then they're talking about a moratorium. The problem with Uber, unfortunately, is that they have acquired the services of an ex-municipal employee who then had this other issue around how we implement the act, even those that are not in the act. I mean, the issue around moratorium doesn't arise, it's nowhere in the act. But then they try to bring it in and say you can improve the act because of one or two of this nature. And we spent some time discussing this thing with them. But also I think they were confronted when they were applying. Meter taxis says no provinces, we can't give them operating licenses because there's a moratorium. So they're then trying to say the provisions are limited in terms of that. But the issue of moratorium is not in the legislature. The issue of moratorium is a determination, even under normal circumstances, if the planning authority can say we can't accommodate it, can accommodate any more vehicles in a particular route, they can decline the application. Just that in terms of power, they need can refer you to another route which is not congested. But if you then decline because you then want route A, which is congested, they can still decline it. So the issue of a moratorium, one, does not arise, but two, does not necessarily mean that the applications are declined based on moratorium. Slide number 8. Slide number 8 is the again, I really don't understand this. Because they want to then say that when we say, this is a, remember now from here on they are now talking general to the principal act, which is a good thing. We listen to people who make proposals. They're then saying that Section 82 of the Principal Act, before the minister publishes regulations, he or she must the MEC must publish a draft for comments. I think this is 10-2H2, says the minister, they want to add must publish for comments. Any regulations that we publish, we definitely say them must be public comments. So that is standard. But two, PAJA also forces us to do that. So there are no regulations that we then publish arbitrarily. So as much as that is welcome, but it is taken care of in the manner in which government does publish regulations. The 54.5, and this goes into really the manner in which the application, I mean the types of vehicles. Although they support what we are saying in terms of specifying the vehicles, engine numbers, VIN numbers and stuff, the issue is it will still limit the ability of Uber to contract Mukonya, because really the practice as is now, they can contract any booth. Let us have a vehicle in good condition, they can contract your services and you can go and pick up jeeps taking from A to B. Now we are saying if you are providing that service in terms of the act, you must have an operator license. So what it means then is that as they then call for people to register into their database, it should be people who have operating licenses. Or like they are doing now, they should facilitate that the people that they recruit into their database, they assist them to obtain operating licenses. Because it is not allowed in the country to ferry or transport passengers, or even if it's one, for reward, and then you do not possess an operating license. And then there was an issue around an issue around objections. When you apply the board, operating license board or the PRE, look at objections and address and adjudicate. That is why they have a quasi-judicial structure. They are saying we must add this, that where there are no substantial objections, it must be deposed of some other. So I said, this is you can hear the language, that this is a former public official proposing this thing. Check. It is given, it is provided for. that if there are no objections within 60 days, in fact, normally what they would do is they would then ask for what you call concurrence, and then it was taking long, and then when it is not forthcoming. Now, in the NLTA in particular, those are the two that legislation. In the NLTA in particular, if the consent is not forthcoming from a claiming authority or there are no objections, of course they proceed. As long as it has been done properly, provisions of other relevant legislation, in particular legislation talking to matters of economic regulation, which is the pattern, if they are complied with, to proceed. But it's not really necessary to then still put it in legislation, because once you do an adjudication process that affects the right of another person, that other person has the right to object. Now, from 3.4, we will then chair hand over to Lusanda, and then we will sum up at the end. Ready?
Good morning. Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, and to the Honourable Members and the colleagues here today. Let me just apologize for my tardiness in being late this morning. I will continue with the presentation, starting with the comments that were provided by Mr. Paul Browning, a transport consultant. He had two main concerns that he raised, which was related to the concerns that he has around the compliance with labor laws in the taxi industry, and he felt that the NLTA should address this particular matter in stricter terms. And the response of the department was that this is an area where the Department of Labor has got rights to police, and that we should then take our lead from the Department of Labor, which will then inform if there are cases of non-compliance with the labor laws, and that it is not an area that the regulatory entities can effectively police. And then the second point was related to the fact that you are suggesting that that there should be an addition to the Act, which looks at holding the owners of the vehicles responsible for the actions of their drivers. And the response from the department is that there is already a provision for this in the Act, and that operators can be held liable for criminal acts of their drivers, that this is already catered for in the Act. The South African Local Government Association had various concerns largely related to definitions. As you see on slide 15, that a number of the issues that are raised there are related to various definitions that they felt were not adequate. But a number of them, the department does feel that the definitions are actually adequate as they are, and that some of the issues that they've raised are actually more well-placed in the regulations, and that they don't necessarily need to be in the Act itself. They also raised some issues around the fact that regulations by the, for instance, Section 8 of the Act, where they say regulations by the Minister should also include regulations that deal with the provision of public transport for all categories. And the department also indicated that this is already addressed in the sense that it is already the duty of the minister and department to monitor public transport services and provide public transport services for all categories, that this does not need to then be stated again, and that there is also an NTTR that is now functioning and has the function of monitoring public transport in the country as well. They also commented around various subsections that they need to make provision for consultation processes, which are already, again, catered for, and that there's always consultation, for instance, before the fixing of fees, and that issue is already taken care of, whether it's in the Act or in the regulation. They also had issues with certain clauses which are introducing the matter of they felt that there's a reduction of powers that the municipalities have or the functions related to transport and Singaporean transport services. And for instance, section 11(1)(b) as well as A of the Act, where they said the proposed section is unclear, especially in terms of services provided by the provinces, and that it needs to be well defined. And the department has responded there that this particular matter was discussed with COCTA and that there was agreement on that matter already, and that the criteria may include the issue of capacity of the municipalities in terms of personnel and financial resources. Also, the other matters that they raised around the issue on scholar transport, where they felt that this should also be a municipal function. This is a policy matter, and the minister has got the powers to actually issue a directive otherwise, but as things stand now, the policy says that scholar transport needs to be provided at the provincial level, but that municipalities should then cater for that services, for that service in the ITNs that they develop. Another matter was again on rail issues, where they felt that the Act is actually in contravention of the policy that's currently being developed on rail management. And the department does disagree with this, that rail is still a national function, and that in terms of the constitution, the municipalities must perform rail-related functions in consultation of process. So there is no contradiction with the policy there. And then again, there's what other various issues related to definitions and methods of clarity that they've raised, and each one of those methods has been adequately responded to. In terms of the meter taxi forum, they also submitted comments which also related to some aspects of definition, and most of their concerns were really around the protection of their industry and their business as they know it today. They also raised issues sharply around the method of branding, which they feel that should be compulsory, and that there should be a national approach across all the cities with regards to branding. And this matter will be covered in a fairly detailed manner when the department does publish regulations related to branding, and that it can also be, as we've also responded, that this can also be provided for in municipal bylaws as well. And they've also raised matters related to the regulation of foreign drivers, whom they feel that they need to be subject to very stringent measures in terms of security clearance and whatever testing processes that they are subject to, their public driving permits and all the various matters. So that is also catered for already in terms of the processes that are already there in the regulatory entities and the partnerships that there are with the various regulated entities across the borders. This is already catered for in the operations of the regulated entities, as well as the cross-border agreements that already exist. They also wanted they are also objecting to the presence of three-wheelers or tic-tac taxes, as they are known, being incorporated within the Act, as they feel that they do not conform to safety regulations. This is in slide 24. And the response there is that it really is up to the planning authorities to decide which kind of public transport services should be operated within their areas, and that the integrated transport planning development process will then indicate which kind of services are appropriate for which areas of which city, and that municipalities are also able to make bylaws to supplement Section 70 of the Act, and that the City of Swan is actually already in the process of doing this. And they also raised issues around matters of the Code of Conduct, again related to the regulation of foreign drivers and how they obtained their PDPs and how they obtained the licenses that they have to operate. And again, they raised the matter under Section 8, the matter of color coding and national branding, which I've already alluded to earlier. The other matters that they raised were related to the catering for persons with disabilities, and they felt that this should also apply across the board to all modes of transport, and a matter that we have indicated that it already does apply to all modes of transport as things stand now. And they also felt that the IPPs or the planning, the way planning is done at municipal level now, it doesn't really cater or speak to their operations with their taxes. And we've indicated that, that the current process of planning actually does take into account, or the municipalities are supposed to take into account all modes of transport, including meter taxes, within their areas of operation. And they've also raised a matter around concessionary fares that must apply across the board and to all modes of transport. And we've also indicated that is already, that this is already the case now. They also felt that they need to be involved in the intermodal planning committees at the municipal level, and we've indicated that this is already catered for and that they can actually be part of those intermodal planning committees, that the law does not disallow this in any way. So generally the views that they've raised is really around protecting their interests and their, the threats that they feel encroaching in their business operations. So all those matters have been clarified in great detail in the responses that we have provided. I'm just going to move then to 3.7, which is slide 33, which is looking at the Uber Drivers Cape Town Guild. They provided their own comments as well. And they, their comments on slide 33 look at section 1 as well as 11 and 66 of the Act, where they are indicating that the minister should set up a task team to assess figures from Uber and its partners to ascertain a fair model based and with respect to their labor relations issues and their constitutional rights. This is mostly related to the problems that they've had with Uber. And this matter, the department has responded that it is noted, but that it will mostly be reflected in detail in regulations, and that it is not government policy to actually set fares, except in the case of subsidized services, and that e-hailing services don't meet the criteria to be regarded as subsidized services. And the clarification is also provided that it's not government policy to limit vehicle numbers unless there is a properly approved ITP that indicates that numbers should be limited. So most of the matters that they've raised really are related to the problems that they've had with being operators contracted to Uber, and a number of them will have to be addressed in them engaging Uber further. The Greater Dawoong United Taxi Association also raised mostly general matters related to operations in the Greater Dawoong area, where they've brought a lot of operational issues that did not necessarily apply to the Act or the proposed amendment bill. So these will be referred to the PRI that is in charge of this kind of issues in the Northwest. The Naledi Municipal Taxi Association also has similar issues with the other taxi, with the other association, which is the Greater Dawoong one, as well as the Shwezwe Naledi United Taxi Association. Most of the issues that they raised were actually operational matters that were referred to the provincial regulatory entities that operate. Same as with the Kasuku Taxi Association. And then there is Mulisi William Katani. There were some comments received from them as well. Primarily, these were general matters. He raised matters around the lack of cooperation from departments, including transport, around how tenders or transport contracts are issued, where he feels that there is some unfairness in the system. And the response is that the Principal Act actually requires the structuring of the current contracting system, and that this is already catered for in terms of the Act. And he's also raised issues around the fact that they were required to submit their lifelong permits and now have operating licenses which have an expiry date, and that this has somehow disadvantaged taxi operators. And the response there is that the conversion of permits to route-based operating licenses was decided on as national policy at the time when the Principal Act was drafted already, and in 2008. This was to facilitate proper regulation and planning of public transport operations, and that it had to be done in this way. And he's also raised other issues related to the taxi recapitalization process, process which don't have really much to do with the amendment bill and administrative issues that will need to be raised in a different forum. The MEC for Roads and Transport in Gauteng, MEC Badi, also had comments that he made particularly related to this is slide 39, 3.13. Since the slides are not complete.
No, it's just the one.
Okay. The comments that the MEC made were largely related to the matters that were raised for inclusion by Gauteng related to the ability of a province to pass legislation or to enter into an agreement with one of more municipalities for the formation of what Gauteng would like to see a transport authority operating within the Gauteng area. And the response for that is that the suggestion is to empower the MECs to make regulations on the more detailed structure of the fees, and the department does not have an objection to this insertion, but that the suggested wording will have to be expanded. And the other comment also said that the province already has this power that the MEC also spoke of, but that the department has not, there's no objection to the suggested insertion. So there was no objection to what the MEC for Roads and Transport Housing had proposed. There was also some further comments here related to they also wanted that this section also be added here, as I had already mentioned, that they are actually interested in Gauteng as establishing a transport authority that would then have one or more municipalities enter into an agreement with the provincial entity. And again, as I said, the department does agree in principle to the suggested decisions, and that the exact functions that will be allocated to such an authority and the wording of the provisions must then be discussed further. And that takes us to the end of the presentation. Thank you very much. We'll then go into the overall summary.
Honorable Chair, just in summary. Chair, almost all of these organizations, people, almost all of them, we have consulted them. Not once, but a couple of times. We started this process, Chair, as usual, with a discussion document, which then culminated to the reasons why we want to amend, but then went to the actual clauses. We meet with provinces on a monthly basis in the public transport forum. We presented to committee of transport officials, which is COTO. We presented and got support of MINMEC, and I think present to the last of MEC bodies. We went through the clusters of government, those that are relevant, and then we got certification from the state law advisor. We went to NetLEC more than once at a time, and then we then ultimately got the support of cabinet to go out for comments, and then we incorporated comments, and then we went to cabinet for final sign off. That's the main reason why we are here. I just wanted to indicate that kind of elaborate process. I think at least at cabinet we did provide a slide for those that we consulted, and I'm sure in the first presentation the colleagues should have also done that. But what is therefore then coming as very material, then that is post all these processes, is the whole issue of transport authorities. Although it's the manner and form that the stakeholders wanted to be, they differ. But there is this realization that transport really knows no political boundaries in terms of municipal boundaries. And therefore, when you plan for transport, it is very difficult to then confine ourselves within the boundaries of a particular municipality. And that is the reality of transport, unfortunately. Let's just talk Gauteng, talk Ekurhuleni, Joburg, and Tshwane. In Ekurhuleni in particular, 70% of the trees that start in that municipality don't end up in that municipality. 70%, that's more than 50%. And then I think around 40 and 50% is the same within Joburg and Tshwane. That is the main reason why a solution and a working cooperation is very necessary. Although we've provided in the manner in which they can cooperate, I think there is this concept of transport authorities that the people want to see in legislation and in South Africa. So that could be something that might not even wait for the next amendment. It is imminent. The second part is chair. The transport operators, in particular taxi operators, have always said that we removed associations, and that is what is creating problems on the ground. In the NLTTA, we had legislated for associations and registrar of associations, but there was specific purpose, because that was an interim mechanism. That was when we were registering all the taxis, associations, and everything else. So that was provided for at the time. Now we took it out in the principal act. They want it. We put it back to an extent that we can legislate for code of conduct and related issues. So I just wanted to mention those two critical issues that are outside of the amendment. But that is what we have. We have met. In fact, Gauteng gave us a 4 or 5 pager in the form of an amendment in terms of transport authorities. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. The next presentation I'm going to be very strict, because there's a memorial service. Probably there's members who would want to go and be in the memorial service. One of us is no more, was there some 2 weeks ago. So probably people will be keen to want to engage. Honorable members, I just wanted to check with you if we can take the next presentation, then we're able to deal with all the presentations and questions and discussions once that has been finalized, if you so agree. Okay. Let me take it back again to yourself, acting DDG. I'm going to give you, I've given you an hour for your presentation on NLTA. I'm going to give you 30 minutes for the next presentation, which is the ARSO presentation.
Me personally, I'll talk for 10 seconds, and that is to introduce the team that has been working with me.
Right on, brother Chile. I know that he's here, right here. I'm just going to what is the
question. I'm finishing this one.
Let me welcome Honorable Keko, Honorable Mlaudi, and Honorable Bande, who arrived when the meeting had already started, and indicate that a leader is never late, but delayed. they were busy on other leadership matters.
No, I mean, they appreciate it.
30 minutes.
I thought of going to finish this. No, not if I see the kitchen or something. Only when you were for when all of the things are better presentation. Garage presentation here, the way I will look at it.
Okay.
Can we hear Atia? Like we indicated, it's going to be a very forced and bonded matter, which actually will be Mr. Chu.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members, the acting DG, colleagues. Chairperson, the presentation that we're going to be making, I just want to quickly go back as a reminder in respect of what had already been presented, because previously, the last engagement that we had taken submissions that were made by members of the public, and we detailed the submission to this honorable committee, indicating each and every one of the comments that have been made substantively and the response thereto. We then took the process forward, and what we are going to be tabling here for presentation is the effort that we have taken in terms of the proposal from our understanding in respect of the committee's feeling and the discussions that we had had for all the deliberations that had taken place. So on this basis, Chairperson, the presentation that we are going to go through is in the form of an MS Word, not a PowerPoint presentation. And we have tabled it in a way that it make it easier, because typically we looked at how the deliberations in the committee would transpire, and further to that, the consequential amendments that would then be supported. And this is the basis upon which we have taken it in terms of the legislative process and the drafting legislative style in respect of this. So when we're discussing this, we're looking at the two documents. Firstly, the amendment bill that had been published by this honorable committee that was accepted on the 1st of December 2015, being the amendment bill. So this is the referencing document that we are now projecting. That is the one that becomes the basis of the discussion from which the effort that we are making in this presentation is anchored upon. So now and then, when we're making any reference, we would make reference onto this amendment that had been published by this Honorable Committee in December 2015. Starting first, in terms of the drafting style, Honorable Chairperson, we looked at the proposed definition, and here the document is titled Amendments Agreed to the Administrative Adjudication of Road Traffic Offences Amendment Bill. long title thereof, and on page number 2 in line 2 after the definitions to insert the following. And here, if I may just spend just a few minutes maybe to give a little bit of some brief, the numbering that we have on the far right hand side of the document, I trust Honorable Chairperson members are able to see clearly here. This is how it looks like, Honorable Chairperson. The referencing in terms of the numbering, we're looking at the published document that was made in December and making reference to the numbering that appears on the far right hand side. So the first one is in relation to the definition that has been proposed. The first addition that we have made is on page 2 in line 2 after the definitions to insert the following, and this is what we had established seems to be the agreement, and therefore we want to be able to table this: to establish and administer rehabilitation programs to provide for the establishment of an appeals tribunal. We have also further taken in some of the input that had been made in the form of the written submissions and the oral submissions that members of the public had made. That becomes the very first one in terms of the inclusion of that establishment of rehabilitation programs and the provision for establishment of an appeals tribunal. On clause number 1, which is still on page number 2, after line number 6, to omit paragraph A and to substitute it with the following. And paragraph A, in essence, refers to the type of documentation that would be required to identify a particular person. And in this respect, we are aware that the Companies Act of 1973 has already been repealed. It is now replaced by the Companies Act of 2008. And the formative style that we're presenting has already incorporated there so that members are able to see exactly how it is going to appear when the amendments have been accepted. By the substitution in the definition of acceptable identification for paragraphs D and F of the following paragraphs respectively, a company certificate of incorporation or name change that is issued in terms of now the new edition Companies Act 2008, Act number 71 of 2008. And then in number F, a clear, legible and certified copy of the applicable certificate or the document that is referred to in paragraphs A to paragraph E. The third edition on page 2 after line number 15, again line number 15 making the reference on the far right hand side of the published amendment bill to insert the following paragraph: by the substitution of the definition of date of service of the following definition. And in this respect, Honorable Chairperson, it was something that was referring to section 1 of the definition in the current Act vis-a-vis section 30 of the Act, and the contradictory aspects relating thereto. So this one brings about clarity of interpretation so that there would not be any problems there. The date of service means the date on which an infringer has received the relevant document served on him or her under Section 30. Whereas the previous notation was something that was importing the requirement for the signing of that particular document. And that, by interpretation, will then invalidate there and provide a legal problem whenever somebody else would have been served but might claim that by the fact that I did not sign that particular document automatically nullifies it. We're also taking into consideration the implications of the new additions of the service method. Remember, at the present moment, the Act only talks about service in person or by registered mail. And now the new inclusion of what we had proposed is the addition of electronic means of service. And in that respect, you would make it much easier when you have a new definition in terms of the receipts, of that relevant document that would have been served on him or her in terms of the requirements under Section 30 of the Act. Again, now on the fourth one on page 2 in line 16, to substitute the definition of electronic service. Now, when it comes out to electronic service, Chairperson, the consideration that we had made was not to fall into the trap or the temptation of trying to define the electronic service itself in this particular respect, but to take cognizance of the fact that you do have an interaction within a number of other legislative pieces. In this respect, we know the Electronic Communication Transaction Act. You do have situations where the Department of Trade and Industry might also consider certain elements that would be key to the service of those documents, and therefore you do not want to have a situation where if there are any contradictory provisions, we have to keep on coming back to the portfolio committee and follow the long parliamentary process. In this respect, we then said electronic service means electronic services as being prescribed, and one then looks into the total holistic body of the legislative provisions in order to have the correct, updated, applicable definition of that particular service. On page 2 in line 28, to substitute the definition of infringement with the following definition. And this is something that is also taken, Honorable Chairperson, from the comments that have been made, particularly from the first presentation that was made by Ms. Alta Swanepoel. And it's something that would relate to Section 17 that contradicts Section 31 of the Act. Section 31 provides that the validity of an infringement notice is not subject to the laws of prescription, and one is able to place reliance in terms of the legislative body of work, and we know that any issuing authority can be able to collect on any outstanding infringement, be it 3 years, be it 4 years, or be it 7 years down the line, the total prescriptive period, as long as it is within 30 years. However, there is a contradictory part in terms of the regulation that is based on Section 17 that says an infringement notice needs to be served within a 40-day period. To that respect, the proposal that was then made by Alta Swanepoel and also supported by the JPSA was making specific provision under Section 34 so that there would be a mechanism of the reissue of an infringement notice, an applicable case letter, or an enforcement order in that respect. So when we looking at that, we said it is not something that should only be prescriptive in terms of the type of legislative parameter that it falls on. At the moment, we're only dealing with the road traffic. Therefore, we said the infringement would then be something that can be tied on any one of the road traffic and road transport. We then have an option of either defining every one of them, saying an infringement notice means an omission in contravention of this Act, or in terms of the National Land Transport Act, the Cross-Border Road Transport Act, in terms of the SANPARKS, and therefore instead of defining each and every one of them, the proposal that was then supported by Ms. Alta Swanepoel in the presentation was it made it easier to then group all of them, that it is all those contraventions related to road traffic and road transport legislation, and thus the new definition of the infringement as we have there under number 6. Clause number 2, that clause is rejected, and the reason for the rejection is it makes it easier for contextual reference in order to read this so that the amendment could be able to fit nicely into the new body of the new amended bill that would then be read, and we then replace it with a new one. Section 4 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution in subsection 1 for paragraph A of the following paragraph. And in this respect, it is something that is intended to be able to bring contextual reference in terms of the adjudication and the preeminent focus when it comes out to the ARCO legislation. And it makes it much easier for reading all that. A says to administer a procedure to discourage the contravention of road traffic laws. Instead of supporting adjudication of infringement, because this is the intrinsic requirement of the agency to be able to deal with, to specify and say to adjudicate on infringement as set out in subsection 2, and to hear appeals by infringers as may be prescribed. And this is two additions that were supported by SALGA, supported by the JPSA, particularly Justice Project South Africa, when they were claiming that some of these things give too much power to the infringement agency, and therefore you need the establishment of an independent committee or body that would be overlooking everything else that the RTIA made, and therefore the establishment of an infringement tribunal that was also supported by the presentation that was made by Salga. The second part is by the deletion in subsection 2 of paragraph E, the deletion in subsection 2 of the word end at the end of paragraph F, the substitution in subsection 2 for the full stop at the end of paragraph G of the expression end. And these are things that are intended to be able to bring textual reference and much clarity in terms of the reading there. One of the important parts is then under paragraph E, by the addition in subsection 2 of the following paragraph, administering prescribed rehabilitation programs for habitual infringers, including but not limited to driver retesting to determine driver fitness. The published amendment bill in this respect had an additional subroman 2, and this one, by having had a lot of consideration and also by the comments that we had received and deliberation in the committee, this is the part, Honorable Chairperson, in the substantive document provides for compulsory community service at government mortuaries and hospital trauma. And the committee had then warned that it would be something that becomes too harsh, because you would then be able to render these people subject to traumatic experiences. And the comment that was directly made by Honorable Maswangani had warned that we need to perhaps be able to reconsider this. So we are taking that Romans figures up too, to be taken out, but then this is not limited by the inclusion in respect of what we have made provision for. You will see it is also some of those things that are covered in section 34 in the regulations that empowers the minister to can regulate on anything else that would be supportive of the intention of the legislator and the provision that is made in this respect. The next ones are also those comments that would bring textual reference in respect of how the amendment in itself is going to be ready, by the deletion of the word and the addition of full stops, so that you have grammatical completion in the reading of that new clause. Then the following new clause be added in terms of amendment of section 11 of Act 46 of 1998. Section 11 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by substitution for subsection 2 of the following subsection. In this respect, it is just the naming convention that Honorable Hamsinger had also asked what the real intention was behind this, whether it was something only intended to be able to bring clarity or to enforce the intrinsic power that the authority is being empowered. And that is the reason why we then looked into that, the changing of the naming convention from an agency to the authority. It may pay to the persons in its employ such remuneration and allowances and may provide them such pensions and other benefits as the board may determine with the approval of the minister. The comment and the warning that was particularly given by Honorable Khadebe, it was also supported by Honorable Maswangani. Initially, it's something that looked at the complete deletion of the requirement for the minister and the minister of finance. However, by having taken into consideration the comment that had been made that you cannot disempower the minister, in as much as the governance processes and the prescripts related thereto, was the board in all cases is supposed to be acting on behalf of the minister, having been appointed by the minister as such. However, we then had an agreement that you will remain with the approval of the minister. The Minister of Finance is not directly named now in the new convention, because in any case the PFMA is always going to be applicable within the whole body of work. But for administrative efficiencies and for governance prescripts, we then the proposal that we leave it with the approval of the minister in that respect. The new clause on page 3 on line 39 to insert a new clause that amends section 17 of the Act, as amended by Section 8 of Act 72 of 2002. Section 17 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the deletion of subsection 1F4. subsection section 17(1)(f)(4) and this one, the whole of section 17(1)(f), Honorable Chairperson, provides the related elective options that one needs to be able to exercise upon being issued with an infringement notice. And in this respect, we have taken into consideration particularly the comments that have been made by JPSA, as well as the comments that have been made by Ms. Alka Swanepoel, taking cognizance of the frustrations experienced by all the law enforcement officers and the magistracy. In this respect, it provides under A, the Roman figure 1 provides for the payment of an infringement, the discounted payment of that infringement, the submission of a representation, the automatic election to go to court, or the right to be able to nominate the person that would have been responsible for the vehicle at the time that the infringement was committed. And this becomes a consequential amendment in terms of the acceptance of the proposal for the inclusion of an infringement appeals tribunal, based on the need to be able to balance the power between the RCIA as the authority, as well as all the other issuing authorities. In this respect, once we include the establishment of an infringement appeals tribunal, it automatically then balances the power so that an individual does not have direct automatic right simply to go to court in the first instance. So this deletion is the one that is consequential to the inclusion of an infringement appeals tribunal. And it therefore means, in terms of reading the complete administrative body of law, in terms of FAJA, the promotion of administrative justice, we know the reasonableness in terms of the administrative duties and actions would be 180 days. And in this respect, if one wants to be able to challenge anything that had been decided by the infringement authority, one would take these matters to that established infringement appeals tribunal. And therefore, those people that are abusing the privilege of automatically going to court will not be able to have that first option. They would have to take it to the infringement appeals tribunal. And this is what is intended as a consequential amendment to the inclusion of an infringement appeal tribunal. Section 19B of the Principal Act is also amended by the substitution in subsection 1, the words preceding paragraph A of the following words: if an infringer makes an insufficient payment to the agency being the authority in terms of this act in respect of a fine or check used for the payment, and these are just textual references that we're making, and it has implications in terms of the proposal that have been given for the deletion of a warrant of execution. And that is the justification that we provided, that the enforcement order now becomes the one that is the essential power of the administrative processes. And therefore, you would not issue a warrant of execution, but instead effect the enforcement order that would block any successful application or for any transaction that one would want to be able to do, either the traffic department, the licensing authority, or within the whole ambit of the administrative road traffic aspect. So this elevates, in terms of the subparagraph C, elevates the force of power to an enforcement order instead of the issuing of a warrant of execution. A new clause to follow clause number 8, which is the insertion of a new chapter now, a new chapter 3A, and Honorable Chairperson, this is a consequential amendment that we effected on the basis of the contribution that has been received from the oral presentations as well as the written presentation, one that was made by Alta Swanepoel, explicitly elucidated by Mr. Howard Dembowski from Justice Project South Africa, and also supported by SAGA in this respect, being the inclusion of an appeals tribunal. And we have taken quite a lot of time here to be able to provide an understanding of how the infringement tribunal will be established, how it is going to be operating. Here we then looked at the best placing in respect of this provision would be the inclusion of a new chapter, big chapter 3A. We are considering in this respect, Honorable Chairperson, administrative justice and internal procedures. We're saying the new inclusion of section 23B any infringer aggrieved by any decision taken by the representation officer in terms of this act may lodge an appeal with the appeals tribunals within 30 days of receipt of the reasons for the decision and lodge in the manner and on payment of fees as prescribed by the minister. And in this respect, it is something that goes out directly to be able to protect the intention of the legislature, which, as we have expressly elucidated, is something that has been abused. And it's also contradictory to the legislative imperative, because you can't say you want to remove all infringement from the court processes, deal with them administratively, and at the same time say, if you don't like what we're doing, then you can directly go to court. And in this respect, that's why the inclusion of an infringement appeals tribunal, so that everything else that happens can be dealt with administratively with the necessary efficiencies that would be introduced. The composition of appeals tribunals we looked at, and the new inclusion of a 23C, the appeals tribunal consists of no more than 5 members who must be appointed by the minister. And in appointing the ministers, the members of the appeals tribunal, the minister must have regard to the person's technical knowledge, experience in a field related to road traffic and transport legislation, or any special skills. And in this respect, that's why the inclusion of both elements of road traffic as well as road transport legislation, so that you cover both elements in that respect. The qualifications, the expertise and experience in matters concerning the legal, financial and economic matters, and through media and notice in the Government Gazette, invite members of the public to nominate persons who comply with the criteria contemplated in paragraph A above for the appointment of these members as the appeals tribunal. The new edition of the section 3, the members of the appeals tribunal are appointed on a part-time basis. And we're also making provision for both the chairperson and deputy chairperson of the appeals tribunal. Generally, the minister must appoint one of the members of the tribunal as chairperson, and the appeals tribunals must, at its first sitting, appoint another member as a deputy chairperson of the appeals tribunal. And then we provide just some of the administrative processes. The chairperson is absent or for any reason unable to act as chairperson, the deputy chairperson must act as the chairperson of the appeals tribunal. We then also included those persons that would not be qualified to be members of the appeals tribunal, and the disqualification number one would be an unrehabilitated insolvent. If the person has been removed from public office, if the person is in the employ of the state, if the person has been convicted of an offense for which the person has been sentenced to imprisonment without the option of a fine, unless the minister, having had due regard to the nature of the offense and the circumstances of the case, is satisfied on reasonable grounds that the person is a fit and a proper person to be so appointed. We added a new paragraph also in terms of the condition of appointment and the terms of office of the members. The chairperson, the deputy chairperson, and any other member of the tribunal must, for each day or part of a day in any month on which the duties attached to the office concerned were performed, be remunerated and paid the travelling and subsistence allowance at such daily rate as the minister, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, may determine from time to time. A member of the appeals tribunal holds office for a period of 3 years and is, on expiration of such member's terms of office, eligible for reappointment. The other conditions of appointment will be as prescribed by the minister, and the different categories of appointment may be prescribed in respect of different categories of members. In this respect, this is something that is intended to become the referee, so that you have a new mechanism of overlooking the operational processes and the adjudicative framework that the RTIA as the authority would be responsible for. At the moment, if anything that happens and one is not happy with a decision that has been undertaken, they could be able to lodge an appeal, perhaps maybe appeal to the registrar, but however, they can go at any point to go to the court. But however, it is something that is contradictory in terms of the spirit and the letter of the law. That's why we then want to be able to provide this conduit. In any case, anybody that wants to rush to the court process, the court would have to, in the first instance, look to see whether there is an appeals mechanism within the whole environment. And if there is that appeals mechanism, then the court will be able to redirect that person to go and exhaust those mechanisms first. If they're not happy, It is a constitutional right that all administrative decisions are also going to be always subject, if one wants to be able to take it to court, if they are not happy with the decision that would have been taken by the infringement appeals tribunal. But it is something that is independent and that sits external to the RCIA. The vacancies, therefore, we're also making a pronouncement that the vacancies, if anybody else becomes disqualified, in reference to Section 18E, or whether in case where the member resigns, by giving notice in writing to the minister and that resignation takes place, the minister may, subject to due process, remove any member of the appeal tribunal in addition to the qualification criteria that would have been included under 23C. If that particular member is found guilty of misconduct or failing to perform the duties of a member or to perform such duties diligently and efficiently, or if a member, because of any physical or mental illness or disability, becomes incapable of performing a member's duty or performing the duties diligently and efficiently, any vacancies in the office of the member of the appeals tribunal must be filled by the minister through the appointment of another member in terms of Section 18C. And that 18C is the one that we make in provision for an objective process where the minister publishes and members of the public can be able to nominate and start the whole process. And the member so appointed holds office for the unexpired portion of the predecessor's term, being that particular person that would have been rendered unable or incapable, or that would have been found guilty according to the prerequisites that have been made there. Under 23H, you said the appeals tribunal must sit at office of the authority on such days and during such hours as the chairperson of the tribunal may determine. The presence of at least 50% of the members will be necessary to constitute a sitting of the tribunal. If both the chairperson and the deputy chairperson are absent from a sitting, the members present must, from among their number, elect a person to preside at the meeting. The chairperson may, for purposes of hearing an appeal, summon any person who may give material information concerning the subject matter of the hearing, or has in his or possession or custody or under his or control any document which has any bearing upon the subject of the hearing, to appear before him or her at a time and a place specified in summons to be interrogated or to produce that document, and the chairperson may retain for examination any document so produced. To administer an oath or to accept an affirmation from any person called as a witness at the hearing, call any person present at the hearing as a witness and interrogate him or her and require him to produce any documents or processes in their custody or under their control having a bearing on the particular matter that would have been done. Section 23I, we then deal with the decisions of the appeals tribunal, which may confirm, again remembering that it is the decisions that would have been taken preeminently by the agency that they want to be able to review. They may confirm, vary, or set aside any decision against which an appeal has been lodged in terms of Section 18B. The decision of a majority of the members present at a sitting of the tribunal constitute a decision of the tribunal. And in the event of inequality of votes on any matter, the person presiding at the sitting must have a casting vote in addition to that person's deliberative vote. No decision taken by the appeals tribunal is invalid merely by reason of a vacancy in the appeals tribunal, or the fact that any person not entitled to sit as a member of the tribunal sat as such member at the time of the decision was taken. If the decision was taken by the majority of the members present at the time and who were entitled to sit as members of the tribunal, then the appeal against the decision of the appeals tribunal, any infringer affected by the decision of appeals tribunal may appeal to any provincial or local division of the High Court having the necessary jurisdiction in there. An appeal contemplated in subsection 1 must be noted and prosecuted as if it were an appeal against a judgment of a magistrate's court in a civil case, and all the rules applicable to such an appeal apply to an appeal in terms of subsection 1. The addition of 23K deals with the administrative work of the appeals tribunal and the support processes that will be provided by the Office of the Registrar. That, in essence, is one of the key inclusions based on the submissions from the written and the oral submissions that we have made, and we have taken quite a bit of time in providing the substantive elements that will talk to the administrative processes and the operational mechanisms that will be included. Consequent to that, Chairperson, it is important that we note the consequential amendment that needs to take place in respect of Section 17.1F, Roman Figure 4, that then eliminates the automatic right to go to court as one of the elective options. We would then be remaining with four elective options and the protective mechanism that is now included in the new Chapter 3A, Section 23 of the new bill that we are proposing, with the addition of an infringement appeals tribunal. We then go to the published one on clause number 9 on page 4 after line 42, omitting as prescribed including postage or electronic service, and to substitute by postage and electronic services as prescribed. Again, something that we take in cognizance of the fact that there could be legislative progress that has been made. We don't want to be able to dictate on that. And therefore, taking into consideration some of the provisions that may come from the ECTA, Electronic Communication and Transactions Act, and other proposals that will be made, we want to be able to take it as would have been prescribed. Under clause number 10, we said one clause has been rejected, and the rejection therefore is something that is consequential thereto and provides for the inclusion of a new clause to follow clause number 9. That is substitution of section 32 of the Act, and the following is hereby substituted for section 32 of the Principal Act. In terms of the apportionment of penalties, any penalty received by the authority in terms of this Act must, as prescribed, be paid over to the issuing authority that issued the infringement notice after deduction of an amount equal to the discount contemplated in 17.1D. Any prescribed fees or monies contemplated in section 13.1D capital A collected by or on behalf of the issuing authority in terms of this Act must, as prescribed, be paid to the authority. Subsection 3, despite any other law, any monies received in respect of any conviction under the applicable road traffic legislation must be dispersed as prescribed. There was the commentary that was made in respect of this particular clause under section 32. We have taken into consideration, in particular, the submission that has been made by SALGA, and in essence had agreed with the basis of what they were proposing and eliminated the proposal that initially had been made. And the essence of the proposal that was made was, in cases where there has been non-compliance by any issuing authorities, the authority would have the power to withhold the related financial portion that would be due to those issuing authorities. And their proposal was, yes, while they accept that, it therefore has to be exactly the same vis-a-vis the agency, so that if there has been any non-compliance on the side of the agency, the related issuing authority should be able to withdraw or withhold any of the financial proceeds that would be due to the issuing of, to the authority in itself. On page number 5 on line 18, we propose to insert a new clause that is amendment to section 34 of the Act, thereby amendment by the addition of paragraph F, H, that deals with the manner in which an infringement notice, courtesy letter, or infringement order may be reissued. And this is something that is very critical. Honorable Chairperson, you would recall two key substantive comments that were made, particularly detailed in the presentation by Ms. Alta Swanepu, when she made comment firstly in the definition on section 1 as well as on section 34. It is something that was also supported by the submission that was made by SALGA, especially in terms of the financial implications of the invalidated notices that have been given, and the frustration of the very limited time frame that has been provided in terms of the ARTO, and that automatically renders the issuing authority sometimes helpless because they're not dealing with everything else that is always 100% under their own control. And in this respect, the proposal that was made was to ensure that the minister can be empowered in dictating the processes or the manner, the procedures that will be required for the reissue of the infringement notices. We have elucidated this and we have given examples of how in a lot of cases people have been abusing the provisions of the Act, and in those circumstances where people would say they submitted representation, not challenging the substantive facts that would have been on the table, but merely challenging the procedure that would have been followed. And the non-compliance in terms of the procedure, you therefore want to be able to say you need to challenge whether you've actually committed infringement or not. You cannot say you must not hold me accountable because you served me by normal mail instead of registered mail. And that has been the preeminent argument that would have been made. So the issuing authority, supported by SALGA, had proposed that we need to be able to empower the minister so that she can provide the mechanisms where a courtesy letter, an infringement notice, or an enforcement order can be reissued under certain circumstances. And this is a new inclusion that then goes to Section 34 of the Act under a new subparagraph H, whereby it would indicate the manner in which an infringement notice, a courtesy letter, or an enforcement order can then be reissued under the applicable circumstances. Honorable Chairperson, this is the attempt that we have made, taking into consideration all the comments that had come and the submission that had made in terms of the oral presentations, the written presentations, as well as the comments and the advisories that have been made by various members. As far as was possible, we had also emphasized, Honorable Chairperson, that we've taken into consideration all the comments that had been made, particularly the comments that were made by Honorable Hamsinger that were related to the operational mechanism. We have noted that, and we said we'll deal with them appropriately. The comments that Honorable Maswanganyi had also made together with Honorable Sibande and Honorable Maswanganyi, we have included those ones that are related thereto, so that you do not come in essence with a completely new type of legislation. All the other comments that the other members had made, we have taken cognizance thereof, and we have sought to ensure that we can combine all of them together and make sure that at the end of the day, the bill that had been presented had been sufficiently amplified, and that being the proposal that we are tabling, taking into consideration the commentary and the advice that this Honorable Committee had given to us. I certainly hope that I did not exceed the 30 minutes, Chairperson, that you have given me. Thank you very much. We will be able to take any other questions. Thank you.
Exceeded by 10 minutes. Thank you very much. Honorable members, I think we should start with the after bill going into let's start with the LLTA as presented here today, and then we'll go into the after and how the discussions went and so forth. Is there issues on LLTA? Honorable Defeitas, Honorable Singer Defeitas, Honorable Maswanga, along the way. Honorable Defeitas.
Chair, may I address you on a point of process before I ask my questions? My understanding, and I could be wrong, was the way that the department had presented the NLTA amendments, the way they had done it, where they went through each of the people who were part of public participation, and they went clause by clause of what they were saying and what the department's response was very useful, because it answered a lot of questions that I had and was directly responding to each of them. In the case of the auto, this step seems to be missed. I mean, I'm very grateful that this has been written already, but I would have preferred to have had a similar exercise to have gone through each individual concern. So I'm just wondering, could we not follow a similar process in this case? I don't want to slow the process down, but there may be questions that would be answered very quickly if we went clause by clause. So I just want to just inquire on that, and then I'll then answer questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Freitas. We did this process before we went on recess, where the explanation of who said what and is it agreeable, that was to my understanding, it was that before we went on recess. Maybe what we can do is to request the committee secretary to send what was presented by RCA on this matter so that we are able to assist you. I think that was done in your absence. But it doesn't mean that you can't get those documents in the store. If you can continue.
Thanks, Chair. I look forward to that. It must have been when I was away. I must just say that my colleague Chris Huntinger also doesn't remember it, but if we do have it, I'd love to see it and then work through it the next day or two so I can have it ready in my mind. So may I go ahead and ask my question?
Yes, sir.
We're looking at the NLTA. The first thing that comes across, and thanks for the presentation, it was very concise and answered a lot of questions for me. So the few questions I have is the following. I'm a little nervous about how reliant and how much reference there is to regulations. How a lot of the stuff that I believe should be in the bill is going to be relegated to regulations. And that makes me a little nervous about that. And I think you need to kind of look at that. Then throughout the presentation a few times it was mentioned that it's the practice of the department that consultation takes place in a number of times, which is quite correct. But I think what a lot of the submissions are saying was that they want to specify that this is the case. You may find in this, at the moment, we have a very good minister and administration that is very conscious about consultation, but you may in the future find that that this may not be the case, and as a result you may find that it, because it's not specified, it may not be as intense as it should. So if we could look at that, I would like it to be that it's specifically specified. Then just going through the slides, on page 18 where it talks about acceptable ITP and it's vague, etc. The word, the response is the word acceptable means that it must comply and so forth. I'm saying, well, let's then say so in the draft. That would satisfy what Selby is saying. Because it didn't really the department didn't really respond in addressing the word acceptable. So that's my suggestion. On page 19, then on 21 again it's talking about prescriptions on meters and so forth. I understand that you need regulations, but surely there should be a framework within which to work. And I'm just afraid that it will all be relegated to regulations, and regulations are just that. They're not as firm and as steadfast, if you like, as being in legislation. And then, it applies to a whole lot of other places throughout this presentation. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jim. To me, there's also, I don't understand why we don't address both of these amendments in the same method. There was a distinct difference in how it was presented today, And I find it confusing that we have two amendment bills under consideration, yet the way that it's presented is are two totally different methods. The one having effect, and the effect of what is considered is shown in the actual legislation, and the other one merely passes a list of comments and opinions about how the department weighs the input. And either of the two would have been great. I find the one being a step or two further ahead than the other one, and it would have been nice to then have both in a form where one could then see the real impact and progress of the amendment since it's under construction, but it would be, have been better if both were presented in the manner in which R2 presented its presentation here this morning. Because in the reaction now on NLTA, it's still not clear how the actual wording, because we're dealing with definitions which is far technical and advanced. New concepts are introduced here now. So it might have implication in manners that we don't even realize this morning. Yet we are requested to comment on it. Chair, then to get on to what we expected from you to do now, is to react on the presentation on NLTA, then page 9. On the operating licenses, some important detail to my opinion went missing here. On page 9, under TCT, there was a whole argument which was that was presented between the importance of in having an origin-based operating license procedure opposed to a destination-based operating license, and the argument was made, you won't find it here because it was something that was presented, and that's why I'm saying I find that having gone missed. Being someone from a rural municipality, I find this a lost opportunity if a origin-based operating license system would by implication be allowed. So therefore, in protection of economic opportunity for rural areas, I would then argue for the inclusion of a sub-definition under operating license being not necessarily origin-based, but where there is enough competence, then also a destination or a route-based. So that you don't find that only the big metros benefit, but that we also look at economic empowerment for rural areas and a gradual development of economic strength other than just concentrated in metro areas. So that's something that in a way went lost, which I recall from memory, which I would suggest as a finer definition around what you offered here under section 39 subsection 3. That we would consider that. Chair, the next point that I would like to make is talks to section 62, which is here in terms of clause of the bill 36, still on page 9, where section 62 was presented by TCT and proof, and it's all about proof of insurance. Now the whole issue of proof of insurance is wiped off the table by referring to section 21 subsection 1 of RAF, which I don't think is quite necessary, because proof of insurance still to me is a very important argument, and it shouldn't conveniently be related to fault or no fault. There are enough court cases that would set this argument aside, because there is still an argument to be made out in terms of the necessity to have insurance. Your reference to section 21 subsection 1 in terms of loss or damage resulting from bodily harm is something very specific, and it still applies. We had very recent court cases around that. So the necessity and proof of insurance to me talks to something very specific and should be considered, and it's not just a matter of liability which is addressed to a particular individual of a vehicle or owner of a vehicle. We currently do sit with a huge backlog on the payment of claims, and parallel to that then I say insurance would have a very important role and can be very useful in order to get payment to people that have been injured or sustained loss in a particular way. On page 10, under that section 41 subsection 1, in terms of the cut-off date, the procedure and the acceptance of this amendment bill is under huge pressure because of that date, and I would seriously recommend that you address the date irrespective of how soon the bill can be passed in Parliament, because we're 1 month away from the cut-off date, and surely we can't sit with a situation where a lot of people would not be able to operate. Then page number 9, in the response part of the comment that talks to section 1, the response simply said this would not be appropriate. I would really ask for more detail there. What would the reasons be for the reaction that this would not be appropriate? It's been, that's about the third sentence under response, on page 11 under response. The department agrees that the definition of e-hailing should be asserted into degrees that should be defined as long as it applies other modes of public transport, as this would not be appropriate. If you could elaborate on that. The second last sentence really emphasizes the whole dilemma which we saw with Uber, because suddenly out of the blue Uber was there, and here again we attempt to handle it, but then we say as long as they comply with the requirements of the Act. I think we should have learned a big lesson from Uber and rather be a step ahead in terms of being specific, so that we don't have a second incident like we had with Uber, in an act having gaps and some system of any kind then outsmarts the act, and you have a lot of other people which we also have a big responsibility to, and we can't support that. So I'm all against and not in favor of, you know, this expression like you put it here, as long as they comply to that. What if they don't comply? Then we must be specific. Yes, I agree with you, sir, but now on page 15 and on page 25 we pass the same attitude, in that we say with petty cars, you know, that's someone else's responsibility. With tuk-tuks, that's someone else's responsibility. Shouldn't we be more specific in not allowing for the one to react in a particular way and the other one to react in a different way? But isn't this National Land Transport Act the one that should be as specific as to prescribe and to regulate, instead of leaving the onus to provinces or anybody else? Just a question of, you know, what then is the intention of this act? Because, as you would see on page 15, Jen, the middle section there, which is the darkest color, last sentence, if it becomes necessary in future to regulate the act, will be amended to a letter that we... Why can't we take time and be specific and sort it out and regulate this, instead of leaving it for a later stage? Page 25 has the same effect, in that we say that two or three wheeler vehicles such as tuk-tuks and longsters come, again, leaving it to someone else or for a later stage or for another day instead of being specific on the issue. Then also, again, on operating licenses, the distinction and specification around commercial transport, our operating license criteria, and then also charter license criteria. To be specific on that and to categorize it and to make sure that it would be a standard over all the provinces.
Page.
This is again on page 11. Page 13, the middle paragraph under the comment section from Uber talking to section 54, subsection 5 of the Act, where it says that it is in cases where it is not possible for the applicant to specify the exact type of vehicle when making an application, because the application may not own the vehicle at the time. If I recall correctly, then this was all about the specification. It talks to specification and it talks to procedure, which I think should be separated, so that one would have to have particulars in terms of an application on the specification, but then in terms of ownership, which to me are two things, ownership and the specified vehicle. So I would want to see these two things separated, because I do acknowledge that in practical terms there might be instances where at the time of application these facts can't be available to that individual, but therefore, you know, the request then to separate the two. You do say under that same paragraph that the department agrees to the proposed amendment. So what do you then agree to? That the vehicle must be specified, or that the owner must be known? So there's a bit of confusion to me there on which of the two. So I've listened to you. It's my time now to pose my question. I'm sure you'll get time to react. Then, still on page 13, under subsection 59, or section 59, subsection 3, the disposal of the application, where Uber then suggested that all the applications must be disposed of, where the department then says that they disagree with that. I just want a bit more clarity there, because I do understand that the context of this remark was presented under the point which they made around personal particulars. So I do accept that you have to keep records for a specific period of time and for all sorts of others, but then could there be an attachment to that in terms of access to the personal information, because obviously that's the concern, hence the remark. I have alluded on page 15 to petty cars, which I'm not quite sure what that is, where we suggest then that in cases, for instance, like petty cars, it becomes necessary in future to regulate them, the Act will be amended to a later stage. I would argue that, you know, we have the opportunity now, let's rather not have the same case as what we had with Uber. I'm jumping to page 21, Chen, where the Principal Act has been amended, and I'm referring to section 72 in the Principal Act, under response, where it says the NLTR 2009 currently deals with this aspect in detail, will be revised eventually once the bill is passed. Now, the particular linkage between the regulations, there's just I sort of lacked a bit of detail there in terms of the particular section 72, because I didn't have the principal bill with me. I have spoken on page 25 about the necessity to rather be more inclusive than to exclude certain portions of transport, like the tuk-tuks and two- and three-wheeler public transport vehicles of any kind. I would stick to that thing for now. Thank you,
Chair. Thank you very much, Honourable Plan.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I want to very much, by calling to comment on something. Mr. President, myself, I'm in consent. From page 11, I'm going to check. Mr. 11, I'm thinking. I'll check you back. There was a time when I was asked this question, I told this to you. And I still insist, what is our intention? Are we projecting Uber? Are we promoting Uber? And again, I repeat again, you still remember when we were dealing with this public hearing, where we asked that whether do they deal with the people with licenses or people without licenses? Openly, they said they deal both licenses and unlicensed. So, what is our intention then? Whether you respond to them, whether we don't, why should we? Who is Uber? Where are they coming from? I'll put an example. I can't just go to America and come and participate in terms of their laws and regulations, in terms of the country. But here, you continuously do the same mistake. Why do we do that? Where's part of it as a department? Whom do we listen? Do we listen to the citizens of the country, or do we listen to the people illegally? And of which you are not sure where they came illegally or they came illegally to that extent. That is my worry. And if my worry was just to say, this is a public paper for public consumption. We are stuck at the moment whereby our own people, they are fighting each other about their roots by relevant people, of which the person at the end was going to recommend that, you know, they want to listen to the agency and stop this violence. The reason why the key touchy people, they are not involved. I talk in terms of Basco, Santago, and NLTA, those bodies which are there in South Africa. But why are we concerned with the people from outside the country? We were told from the horse's mouth, it is alleged. I don't say that in yet. There are people with passes now. No more doing air transport. But they're still projecting them. You are projecting them. I still repeat. I'm pointing the finger to you as a department. And if you can check some of the inputs from the other bodies from inside the country, you are responsible for just 2 sentences and 1 sentence. But with Uber, 3 full pages, because this is Uber. I don't know what is our intention. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Issues where I'm covered. Just to indicate, Chair, that the department will have to bear with us that the process of passage of this bill might take longer than we thought. and we hope that we'll not have a bearing on other people's employment safety, which will be out of our control. Now it's in our control. So we have set our APPs, and we also have our own APPs as the legislative force. As members have indicated, that in terms of our public participation model, we have to adequately involve almost all the stakeholders who are in this sector. And just want to check in between Chairperson, when we engage with the portfolio committee and they come here, where does the minister come in? We don't want the minister to come back later and say that I was not appraised. Because we are going to meet her in the chamber. So we hope that we take the minister on board from time to time. At your level, we don't account to the minister. So that you are not found to be on the wrong side of the law. In terms of the time frame that you have set for yourself, 8 December 2016, there's no way in which you are going to meet that target. It means there has to be interim measures, Chairperson. And so there's not going to be any problem. The state can provide for interim measures when we are dealing with amendments. There's also some website taking the issue of MEC publishing a draft. What happens if the MEC does not do so? I don't have clarity from somewhere the department says they don't object to that. What does it mean, actually? Is this obligatory on the side of the MEC or optional or otherwise? My colleague Bander touched the issue of Uber. Uber, Jefferson, as he has said, they don't have a vehicle, they have no installment, they don't maintain a single car. I don't even know they are Uber. What they have is a laptop to operate a system. And they don't even have any liability. I think what we should also take in seriously is what is in slide 83, the presentation by the driver. It's very serious what they presented. And I've done some work with some of the people in that industry and find that this Uber system only empowers Uber P2I. In the main, it does not empower our people. So we can't have a system which is not yet economically empower people in that sense. Because in slide 83, where the Uber drivers have raised issues, your response was that as government, you are not to set that, except as government, you are not to limit number. I think our response is different. We are a developmental state. Don't mean that. In a developmental state, the state deliberately intervenes in directing the economic cost. You don't leave it to the whim of the market force. And Uber is the market force. As Comrade Banda has indicated. We can't, in the main, just not look broadly on what drivers have raised. There are many drivers who are out of the system now and are still owing financial institutions because of this Uber system. It's very disempowering. So the department, as a state office, must deliberately intervene in this sector. to protect the actual operation, not Uber itself. We don't have a problem with innovation in the industry, but that innovation should not come and disempower South African voters, South African citizens. Many, many people today are very poor and they are in trouble with the banks because of this. Uber just collect money for sitting with a phone and just an app. They don't have any liability with anybody. Nobody much to them, they don't pay anybody a salary. So, Chairperson, this issue as public representative, if the department does not look deep into it, we'll do so. Because they have been elected by the people to look at their interests, and we'll make sure that by the time this bill is passed, it is to the interest of our people, not to the interest of the market. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Just one question on the issue of the contract. There was a whole lot of long discussion on the negotiated contract. Now, I'm trying to read the section here in the presentation. I don't quite get clear as to how we're going to change that arrangement in the amendment that we are going to do. Remember we had was raised much of the comments and the responses referred to the oral submission. There was also a range of discussion that was raised by members on various aspects. One of it I remember is the issue about negotiated contract and how the bill was characterizing solution going forward. And the contention was that what is being suggested to characterize the solution is actually a continuation of the same practice now. Not necessarily going to create the back of the claim of God-given rights by pastors, for example, in the Western Cape, the Golden Arrow, or any other pastors that they have, that the provision that was suggested was not going to change the paradigm, enforcing the integration, enforcing the integration of roads and the feeder system. The example was made about the actual buying out of the current minibus and making way for in Western Cape, particular for MITIC. And I put an example about the old George area. Wasn't any integration other than say we're replacing your route with a bus called Old George. We would give you 350,000 rand to sell your right, to sell your permit to us, and there we go out of business. Now on the current responses, FTDG, with respect, I don't see quite how we're going to change the current situation. Maybe I'm not reading it properly. Maybe you could help us when you clarify. I say that, Chair, noting that this is just a response from the public participation process. We still have to go into that discussion ourselves deeply with the department. And change where we think it's necessary to change, to actually have a pronounce in action the radicalism of the economic transformation. Because at the moment, it's accumulation by the big, and the small one have no voice into that process. So you need to help us to change that paradigm.
Thank you very much. FCDG, I'm going to give you 7 minutes for you and your team to respond. But I think it is work in progress that will still go close by close as this committee in your presence, so that we can be able to know where we are agreeable and where we are not. That's why I'm giving you this short period.
Are there still other members who would like to speak to the issue?
Ula?
No.
Okay. I thought because you're from this, you'll be able to give us more clarity.
Chairperson, 7 minutes is too little, but it's fine. It is okay, Chair. We have taken notes. We can even augment what we're going to say in writing. Chairperson, can I just talk to the process? I think that there's a big misunderstanding. Chair, the two bills came to Parliament around the same time. Chair, it was this committee that then put the ARTO bill slightly ahead of the NLTA. Now, I was in this meeting when the ARTO bill was being explained like this one, clause by clause and explanation. So the ARTO was done, and then the committee went back again, like you are saying, to deliberate, and then the formulation of the amendment, hence they are being in this mess. So it is slightly ahead, the ARTO bill. I think that should be recorded and so with the NLTA, we are behind the ARTO bill. We are at where they were when they presented these responses to the committee. So once we agree, and once we also then get the deliberations and the committee's input into it, we are also going, and even where we promise, we say we agree with the comments, we don't agree. Then we formulate the bill in that fashion. So I just wanted to just indicate, oh no, we are not really all over. But the chair, but then also just to deal with a couple of issues, Chairperson. The other issue is, almost all the people who then made comments on the amendments. Remember, we came here, we proposed amendments, we've been working on amendments for the last year and a half to 2 years. Now, they've been consulted upon and we come to the committee. There's nothing wrong, everybody then comes and suggests something else in the principal act, but it should be noted that we're dealing with the amendments here. And that is to an extent where we do not touch in the main the issues around the principal act, and we note them, and we, because that then becomes a subject of further research. Now, where it says principal act, you will not find that in the amendment bill. It's a new thing. It's what people are wishing should come into the amendment, and there's nothing wrong about that. Now, and I was still going to then indicate where then the bill changes shape materially. It will have to go back to government, because it's not what then the executive would have approved. So again, this is this process here and now. But we are not wishing all of this things. Now, slightly an issue on NTA and Trump and the others, separate, this committee can call anybody anytime. The committee called everybody, others came, others didn't come. If the committee feels the consultation is not wide enough, the committee can still call any other person anytime. That's why we are here. And everybody else, those that we met when we were doing the executive, the administration process, we told them, let's go again and ventilate in front of the committee with all of you. And then the committee then adjudicate and give political direction, because we are now in this political space. Uber, Chair, we are not legislation for Uber.
and we will never do that. We are not legislating for an interest group. And this is the same approach in terms of response that we said to some middleman company that came to make comments about our chairs. We listened to all South Africans in terms of how they are affected and get affected by legislation. And to an extent that we talk to issues, we then respond accordingly in terms of legislation. We are not legislation, for on the contrary, if I think Uber came to the department more than once, they also came here. And we've been maintaining that stance that we cannot create a special dispensation for Uber. So we are not doing that. That is why we insist that if Uber or any other person want to come into this country and operate public transport, they must obey our laws. One, as they exist in terms of operating license and what goes into the operating license. Now, if you look at the Uber model, the only way they can get an operating license, that a vehicle must belong to a person. In terms of that is not only NLTA, even the National Road Traffic Act. The vehicle must belong to a person, and that person must therefore be held accountable for the operation in that particular route. That is what we are saying. Now, it goes back to the issue around insurance. The issue around third-party liability insurance has been removed from legislation for a very long time. And it's because in the country, you cannot have conflicting legislation. There is then this other legislation that deals with those matters. So it is not that we want when we're taking it away, but you cannot double deep in this country. You're not allowed to. You should not. But that is why even those that opt not to go to RAF can go for private insurance claims, and they do that. So the laws are adequate in that respect. I think the issues around NMT and Sageways, where people are saying there are these two-wheeler things that looks like scooters. They are motorized, but they don't operate on the road because they're not on the road traffic. So the share space with the walking and cycling. And this is what the other people are proposing. And this is why we are saying our definition for non-motorized transport will remain like that because it's not motorized. That is another form of motorization. I don't know what you can call it, but and it is not because we are lazy to be innovative. But I can think of something radical that it will happen in 5 years, and it does not happen or even happen tomorrow. So that is the nature of technology. Where as much as you can want to keep up and be innovative, you can't cover all the ground. So, and that is why somewhere we are limiting ourselves to framework legislation and leaving things to regulation, because it is easier to then include in the regs than in legislation. And this is the problem we are having with the date of December, because it is in legislation. And that's why I said earlier on, if it was in regulations, it was going to be much more easy for us. We are not pushing the portfolio committee, we'll never do that. And even if we can push as a Section 76 bill, there's no way we can do it. We will have to find a mechanism to deal with this due date of December 2016. We are seeking legal opinion. The very first legal opinion that says to us the answers are in the amendment. Earlier on when I talked about it, I was talking about why us again putting an extension to 2020, and then we are in 2016 thinking still very far away. So we need to find a way of taking it out of legislation altogether in the amendment. But that does not mean the act as is talks to December 2016. We'll find a legal way of dealing with that one so that we don't create a vacuum. I think the issues around the treatment of Uber drivers by Uber, unfortunately, again, we can't put it in the NLTA. The Labor Relations Act covers employer-employee relations or a contract of that nature in the main. We obviously listen to everybody. It does not necessarily mean that everything else like that needs to be in legislation. And we refer, we get a lot of complaints and we deal with them accordingly. Contracting authority. The difference, the what we brought into the legislation is our realization that municipalities on their own, the majority of them, do not have the capacity to perform the contracting authority function. Now we are then putting back the role of the department and the role of provinces in there. If you look at the definition, we have stressed it, that provinces must and can intervene. In the current situation, they cannot. So that's why we have this kind of challenges. But the manner of whether you buy in or buy out, it's not necessarily a legislation, I guess not a legislation matter, it's a contract management issue. And where we roll out and provide guidelines and minimum requirements to adhere to by municipalities when they roll out BRTs and ITPs, we do exactly that. The only pity thing is legally that function then runs with the municipality. The lever we have as the national department is where we provide funding on the lines of those that we are intervening, by the way, in George. We are intervening in PE. We are intervening in Bombela. And what we've realized is that there's a need for national norms and standards on how they negotiate with the taxi people. On the contrary, Honorable Ramatakane, Cape Town is the first one to realize that you do not necessarily need to buy out taxi operators. They have a role to play. So they're finding coexistence. It is something that they are planning for the rollout of phase two. Unfortunately, not on phase one. Because they learned the lessons from the phase one, where they gave them up to 1 million. And then the million was gone in 2 weeks. And then, but people then lost the economic benefits, the future economic benefits. So we're developing a model for coexistence. But also the representation from this is that we, with BRTs, we want to kill their business. We want to take that kind. We want to create that statement into a myth, not necessarily a fact. Negotiated contracts in terms of the NLTA still as is in terms of the principal acts to break monopolies, to empower previously disadvantaged individuals, and then to see off municipal-owned bus transport. It is not a legal problem, that one, because it should have happened a long time ago, LS 2009. It is an issue of money. There is just not enough money to contract out or to issue new contracts. That is why we're still on interim contracts. There's bits and pieces where there are new contracts. But it is a question of a burden or overladen fiscal. It's not necessarily the illegal problem. So there's nothing wrong with the legislation. I think we can come and say this is what we always come and indicate when we talk about the state of public transport. If we had money, we've got wonderful plans. We would have transformed this system a long time ago. Unfortunately, you would need as a country 3 times the amount of investments that we are making. We're pumping around 18 billion, we need close to 45. And that is across the board, including rail. So it's not a legislative problem. But the matters that was key and critical was that national and provinces were helpless when municipalities did as they wanted to want, but also those that struggled, we could not really go and assist them. But this amendment in terms of the expansion of the contracting authority addressed that issue. Department and province now comes in as part of the definition of the contracting authority. We will just to formalize the structure. There are quite a number of them, one by one. I try to group them. I would then we will try to do what we the same amount of, I mean the same manner in terms of the presentation before we are given permission by the committee to go and amend and not amend and leave and not leave. And next time around, I'm sure that we will be armed with both the principal and the amendment plus the presentation. So that some of the issues are there in the principal act. The issue around charters versus tourism versus other relationships, the act is very sufficient in terms of what they need to do, plus accompanying regulations which have been published for some time in our operation. I think what I found very key was to just clarify the process, but also to just record that we're not really legislating or amending legislation responding to particular interest groups, but we're responding to the challenges that we face as we implement the legislation. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Can we go into other matters? The other issues, acting DG, that we have not been able to fully elaborate on, if you can just send us the response in writing. Any take on ACTO, Honorable Masonga, you can see your hand, and the Honorable Sepo, Honorable Sibande, Honorable Dinsira. Let me start with you, Honorable Masonga.
Thank you, Chair. Welcome the report. That's on the issue of the appeals tribunal. I'm not sure whether all the details of the tribunal, its operation, have to go into this thing. If so, it means they have to look at other issues which I don't see here. On general matters like determination, the proceedings of the tribunal, the legal indemnification, for instance, that whatever members do, RTA or government should take responsibility. They should not take personal responsibility. Issues like disqualifying somebody in the employment of the state. Why not the department and its agency? The state is a very big institution, and you want to benefit from people who are working in other state offices, not necessarily in transport. If you disqualify those who are in the transport sector, I don't have a problem. But if you say the state as a whole, you disempower yourself. There are many people who are more capacitated to work in other organs of the state. So I think we have to be specific. I know other tribunals which don't have this insertion, it's limiting. Yeah, and I think the issue of the demerit system is properly covered, yes, because that's our issue. In particular, cancelling or withdrawing a driver's license,
that's the bone of contention on my side, which we have to, on the side of the committee, the chairperson said, it's something that we have to get a proper, I don't know where is this covered, Mr. Chuwe, as you were talking in terms of clauses and what you have covered. I see Mr. Sassine today is too quiet. Has he been banned from? He has never come here and not say anything. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chairperson. Just a minor on what was read by my colleague, but to seek a clarity on tribunal. About the financial implication that if the department maybe can indicate what budget would be required for proper functioning of for this tribunal, including also how the support structure or secretariat will be established. Because Chairperson, it might mean staff secondment or new appointments, which is a concern, as the wage bill is already too high. Then Chairperson, lastly, they must indicate now that the Office of Registrar will serve as secretary. How will this affect the work of the registrar? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good day, everyone. I think, Chair, let's appreciate the work in progress with regards to the amendment bill. I was also interested in the issue of the appeal tribunal. But I have a concern around on page 8, where in the page where the minister is given a right to appoint members to the tribunal, to serve in the tribunal. There's a subsection there, B, where it is said if the person has been removed from public office. I think there's something missing there, because removed on what basis? There must be something there. I think there's a gap there. Because you may be removed from a public office for political reasons. Does that deny me to serve in the tribunal if I were removed for political reasons? I think there's something there that is missing. If you go to page 11, yes, where it is said the presence of at least 50%. On the constitution there of this tribunal, it is said no more than five. You won't get the 50% if the minister appoints five. That's where the issue of 50+1 comes, because you can't have half a person to say 50%. Because you will have 2.5 if you say 50%. If you need majority, you must say 50+1. That was just my concern for you to consider. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Just a couple of short suggestions. If I recall correctly, we also requested submission specifically from City of Joburg, City of Tswana, to then also submit input with regards to the fact that the project was piloted specifically there, and we thought it might be good to get their direct input. And then also the financial implications to municipalities. We haven't seen any projection on the cost of the implementation of R2 for a municipality. We have an idea
terms of how Metro would go about this, but then it's still not quite clear how many and what portion and what proportion of the total BARTO was actually piloted and implemented and tested. And then there were also some suggestions around rehabilitation, which has not featured again in this amendment or disappeared for some reason. Rehabilitation, the suggestions around a rehabilitation mechanism, which I thought was quite a useful suggestion. Thank you, Chair.
very small point. I think that some have been covered. There was a discussion that that was started by the South around the concern, and I think it was also picked up by someone who said he represented the taxi industry. But it was a finance, or a model of finance, the concern that they had, which we were later, that later was picked up by the discussion. That was the issue about the whole area of suspension. The suspension and or cancellation of a driver's license and the disc issue. The disc issue, we remember the debate that was quite long. And the other issue that was part of that was the demerits point. As I thought you walked away nicely on your presentation earlier, not quite saying what. But that's those are the two things that I think I just want to make a clarity on.
Thank you, Chairperson. Perhaps let me start by acceding to Honorable Maswanga. Mr. Mutatsing, I guess you're awake. You then need to have the first take. You want to take the first take on that? Because I was doing all the talking, Honorable Chairperson, let me accede first to all my colleagues to take any of the questions, and then I will come and deal with anything that you they would not have covered there. Whenever anyone of those ready. Advocate Masombuka, maybe.
Thanks, Honorable Members. Regarding the issue of curating of the tribunal, that is a very good input that is noted, and it will be taken into account. The second issue was relating to the human resource capacity that will be doing the secretariat of the tribunal. In the department, in fact, we do have some models of appeals tribunals, whereby each secretariat is composed of employees within the department. So the secretarial part of it, I think, will move it along the lines whereby employees within the department in that relevant branch will be the secretariat of the tribunal, but the actual members of the tribunal will be sourced from members of the public. That's how far I can go.
Colleagues, any other takers? Okay, then I will just cover the remaining ones. Thank you, Advocate Masombuka. Honorable Chairperson, let me thank all the members in respect of the input that have been made. It is much appreciated. The Infringements Appeals Tribunal, the extent to which we should provide the related details, yes, we do take your input positively, and the challenge is always going to make sure that which aspects that are not yet included, only to include the substantive issues within the Act, so that the related details should be the ones that will be covered in the regulations. Perhaps as a first take in terms of what you have done is to ensure that the key elements would be incorporated. Obviously, we must then be able to separate the operational processes from there. And Honorable Masonga, you're quite correct. Perhaps we'll just do a thorough cleanup in that, as long as the committee have the assurance that all the related substantive issues would be covered, and then we can do the prescription in the actual regulations. Yes, we like the point that you have indicated that we cannot just put a blanket prescription in terms of limitations of state employees. So that is a positive input. Yes, we will definitely have to go back so that we can make better pronouncement on that. It also links in directly with the comment that Honorable Tegu just makes in terms of the removal of members, because yes, somebody else that would have been removed for political reason, it cannot be something that disqualifies you from that. But we then need to then perhaps go back and indicate those key issues that by normal good governance practice, anything that has got criminal record would then be the one that would restrict you in there. And therefore, yes, we take that comment very positively. We'll be able to go back on that. Honorable Sibanda, in terms of the financial implications, it's something to an extent perhaps that links with Honorable Hamsinger there. Yes, we have taken cognizance of the financial implications thereof. The expectation is you don't want to, let me put it this way, we are very wary of coming up with something that would unnecessarily create additional state entities or bodies. That's why in this respect, the administrative processes that would support the infringement appeals tribunal would then be run from the office of the registrar. And the related budget provision would be made as well as for secretariat purposes. It makes it much easier. But in any case, everything else that the infringement appeals tribunal will do, they will not be reporting to the RTIA. They will be reporting directly to the minister. It is just an easy and a quicker conduit of making sure that they can operate efficiently in that respect. So that budget provision will be done by the RTIA to ensure that they operate efficiently then. And that's how we will be in a position then to be able to support it. Another consideration might then be perhaps if the committee maybe would give that kind of advice, maybe it should be something that is run from the office of the Director General. And if you do it from the office of the Director General, perhaps in terms of the general perception it will create is that it is something that is completely removed from the RTIA, and therefore the administrative support and the secretariat services can also be run from that basis there. Yes, Honorable Fogg, we've touched on the removal from members, and thank you very much for that also in terms of the addition for the majority view of it. Yes, we do take it as just an oversight perhaps on our side. Honorable Hamsinger, the inputs from the implementing authorities, from the deliberations that we had, it was our take that yes, the committee has the right. They can request City of Johannesburg or City of Tshwane to come in, but from the input that had been made, it was a recognition and an acceptance that SALGA is a very important institution, and they represent the interest of not only the two implementing authorities in this instance, but SALGA represents the interest of all the issuing authorities. Fortunately, what we have done as the RTIA was to involve not only the implementing authorities of Johannesburg and Tshwane, but we have incorporated the others that are not yet implementing, that are also overseen by SALGA, Ekurhuleni directly in particular, the big metros, eThekwini, the city of Cape Town, as well as all the other big towns. So the intention of that presentation was made by SALGA was that it has a lot more volume and force of effect, because they're not looking only in terms of what is currently happening, but the long-term effect of running the whole system when it is going to be undertaking it. Honorable Ramatlakane, the rehabilitation programs, we have included that, particularly in terms of Section 4. That is why we, yes indeed, based on the comment that was received from the committee, we ran away from that whole issue that the committee warned us about, the unnecessary trauma that would be caused. That's why we said we will remove the need for people to do community service at government mortuaries, because our intention was, if I'm going to cause an accident and end up killing 5, 6, 7 people, I must be exposed to see the reasons and the ultimate result of my irresponsible behavior. But we've taken the warning that the committee said, maybe let's not be too overzealous in that one. But the second element relating to the rehabilitation programs was in terms of making the provision for the inclusion, and then the operational mechanisms can then be dealt with, supported by Section 34 of the Act, where the minister would then prescribe the operational aspect related thereto, which would also include the establishment of rehabilitation schools as well as the related programs to be able to support that. The other key element that you've also mentioned, that other people have made, particularly SA Taxi and to an extent also JPSA have made that, in terms of the suspension of driving licenses and the point demerit system. The substantive comments that people had made did not have any negative cause or in effect in terms of having to change what currently exists. The demerit point are covered in terms of Section 25 of the Act as it is now. The only difference, which we have taken very seriously, is the input that people had made. To that extent, we recognize there are 2,354 separate infringement notices that are tabled in Schedule 3 of the 2008 regulations. The challenge that we then faced was, we had done an analysis on those 2,354 individual infringements and said from those, which ones are the basis upon which there is a loss of life and increased probability of people being seriously injured or maimed, and we then devised a formula. And with the division of that formula, we then allocated demerit points only to those ones that have got a probability that someone can either be killed or they can be injured. So it's not every infringement. For example, if one overstays their welcome at the end of the month, they've gone to the bank, you overstay your welcome at the parking meter, you will be charged for overstaying your welcome at the parking meter, only financial penalty, but there's no demerit point there. So we need to then have even much more thorough engagement in terms of reducing drastically the number of infringements that would have demerit points attracted. And as a first thing, perhaps we should say as a country, we implement this on a phased approach. Perhaps you need to have absolute maximum, maybe only 100 infringement notices that can attract demerit points. Because at the moment, it is everything that is done holistically in terms of the categorization. If you look at those issues that are related to Section 49G of the National Road Traffic Act and issues related to the NLTA, you've got a whole lot of category, about 600, that deals with, for example, the overloading of public transport vehicles. And it is based on which asset has been overloaded and by what percentage, is it between 5 and 10%, and you have a number of those categorizations based on the vehicle mass, the cross combination of that motor vehicle, and also you want to be able to consider the impact that it has on the actual road infrastructure network. So you've got about 600 of those. And then you've got those ones that are related to excessive speeding. And excessive speeding, you've got ones where the speed limit would be 50 kilometers per hour, 60 kilometers, 70, 80, 90, 100, until 120. And based on the percentage that you are over the speed limit, you do have the applicable demerit points there. So you want to be able to look at all those things and say, do people generally end up losing their lives if he's caught doing 71 kilometers in a 60 zone? Yes, you can get somebody seriously injured. In fact, somebody can die if you run over a pedestrian or somebody that was walking there. Yes, the possibilities are there that somebody can die. But that is not something that happens in the normal course of in the normal course of events. So perhaps you want to be able to concentrate on all those issues whereby we have categorized them as direct offenses, where somebody has been caught excessively speeding, doing greater than 30 kilometers per hour in any demarcated zone. And those are the ones that we want to be able to allocate demerit points to. And it is something that will then become practical and easy for law enforcement officers to be able to do that. In terms of the Act, in terms of Section 25, 26 and 27 of the Act, it is adequately covered. It is the regulations that support that, that we need to be able to go back and perhaps do some amendments, in particular reference to Schedule 3 of the 2008 regulation. So, Honorable Ramatlakane, yes, the input that was made, and it's very substantive, because the general perception that people have are those issues that are related to the regulations and the demerit point. And it is not directly linked onto this amendment bill process, but it is perhaps an engagement that we would love to be able to have with this committee to be able to take guidance from you in terms of how we want to be able to implement. We are also not happy about the number of those infringements that attract demerit points. At the moment, it's about 1,900 of the various infringements that have got demerit points. You ask me, is it practical? I don't think it is going to be practical to enforce that kind of a thing. So it is the manner that we engage with things and the determination of the strategic formula that would indicate which ones must be prioritized and which ones must then come into the back burner. And we would want to have the guidance of this honorable committee once we move on to the secondary stage in there. But thank you very much. It is something, Honorable Ramatlakane, that we would put at the top of the priority. The demerit points, particularly from the SA taxis, the Sabua bus operators also, they've also raised arguments that because they keep on driving a lot more, they are therefore exposed more than anybody else to be able to lose their driving licenses. And we want to be very practical and considerate in terms of how we do that. So let me forewarn the committee, it is something that we would want to come back, engage with. It is separate to this and it does not affect the promulgation of the amendment bill. As it is well covered. It is only the regulations and how we implement them. And we want to take guidance and advisory from this committee. I certainly hope that, Chairperson, we have covered everything else, and thank you very much for the input that we have.
Thank you, Chair. Just one remark on the presentation of SALGA being the one that you suggest that should be representative of the municipal input in that they represent Joburg and Tshwane.
Yeah.
I accept that. Although, even as you put it, that SALGA presented a volume of input, none of the input had any reflection on the financial implication of municipalities. A lot of municipalities see this as an unfunded mandate. They have a huge concern how their current revenue streams would be implicated. And all I'm asking for is just a simple number-based projection of what implication it might have on an A, which we know, which is a metro, but then the B and maybe in some instances C great municipalities. Just a simple projection so that we have an idea, because as you know, certain in the design there is a certain discount structure which in comparison definitely must have an implication. And that would give us a certain comfort and also give us answers to the number of municipalities that have these concerns, in that we can refer to particular projections which you can provide.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. No,
thank you very much. I think to me, I think it was more of a comment, but also let me indicate to the Honourable Member that we are trying to get the two pilot sites, that is 200 and 20 metros, to come and just give us an update on what are the lessons that they have really learned out of this whole situation, so that we are able to know. Probably as we will be engaging with them, we may want to add on to what we believe should be able to be part of the brief, issues of financial implications and other matters that we believe will be able to assist us as we going forward. We are in the process of engaging those. That is just a grid. I don't know. It looks like we are done. I will request the honorable members to include the name so that we are able to deal with that of in-house. As for the other members, you may feel free to stay if you feel like, so that you are able to finalize this meeting. But if you feel like leaving, quietly so to me without disturbing the tranquility of this meeting. Thank you very much. We will go into the minutes. Those who are born before technology, you will have to pardon us. We are three what?
No, I got that question. I will submit it in the next one.
I'm tired of people talking to me. So that is why we will hear it. And then the minutes of the 20th of